Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Over the past decade, and especially in the last several years, anti-Semitic crimes have increased significantly. According to FBI statistics, hate crimes against Jews in the U.S. spiked 37% between 2016 and 2017. We are witnessing similar trends in Canada, where anti-Semitic crimes increased by 60% since last year, according to Statistics Canada. Why is it that anti-Semitism continues to thrive? Why won't this irrational hatred die? What factors contribute to the rise of anti-Semitism? Deborah Lipstadt addresses these and many other questions in her book, Antisemitism Here and Now. The number one bestseller in human rights law on Amazon, Lipstadt's book is a provocative page-turner about this ancient form of hatred and prejudice. Deborah Lipstadt is Doro's Professor of Modern Jewish History and Holocaust Studies at Emory University. I am pleased to welcome her to MBIR. Hello, Deborah, and welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you for having me.
So one of the most unique features of the book is its format. Rather than a traditional academic text, you formatted your book as a series of letters between yourself and two fictional people, Abigail and Joe. Why did you format the book in this way?
Well, I started to write the book as a normal, straightforward book. And first, I was having trouble putting my head around it. Did I want to take it country by country? Did I want to take it issue by issue? And I couldn't quite figure out how I wanted to do it. And B, when I did do it, it was just it didn't have any life to it. It was boring. It didn't have any, as I said to one interviewer in England, I said to her, it didn't have any juice. And she said, juice? How can a book on anti-Semitism? She thought I said J-E-W-S. I was saying J-U-I-C-E.
Right.
And a friend who was reading a book then written as letters, but Ta-Nehisi Coates said to me, who knew I was having trouble, said to me, try letters. And of course, letters is an established form. It's been around for ages. And I tried it and it fell into place. So I was very pleased.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, it's really interesting. And it makes it, in my opinion, really readable.
Well, that's what I wanted. I wanted this book. Look, it's a scholarly book. I think it's got 30 pages of footnotes or something like that. So it's clearly referenced and cited and all those kind of things. But I wanted the book to be a hybrid, clearly source referenced so that scholars could depend on what I was saying or check out what I was saying. But I also wanted it to be a book that would be read by non-scholars. I wanted it to be a book that would reach a broader public. The letters format seems to have done that because I'm hearing this from a lot of people.
Wonderful.
In fact, I don't know, a week or two after it was published, one day I received two emails in quick succession. One from a friend who was on a plane, flying home from Paris, where she'd been for business. She was reading the book. And she said, I want to buy this book for my two children, one a junior in high school, one a senior in high school, because I think these are some of the issues that they will face when they get to university. And I was very pleased by that. They're smart kids, so they can certainly read a book. They read adult level books all the time. The next email came from a professor of Jewish studies, a professor of biblical studies at a very prestigious university in the United States. He's in biblical studies, but he's, you know, because he's sort of moves around the edge of Jewish studies, he confronts the issue of anti-Semitism. He reads articles on anti-Semitism. Does anti-Semitism go back to biblical times, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, I love the book. It really cleared up a lot of things for me and helped me think about things in different ways. And then I received about a day or two later an email from another colleague who happens to be Armenian, who congratulated me on the book and said he really loved it. It helped him understand anti-Semitism, which he thinks a lot about because of the Armenian genocide, et cetera. But it helped him think about the issues of prejudice and hatred in a new way. So at that point, I said I was ready to, you know, hang up my coat, take off my shoes and say I'm done. You know, it was very gratifying. It was very, very gratifying.
Right. So I have a question for you about terminology. Academics are acutely aware of the limitations of definitions and are often reticent to define terms. But in order to recognize anti-Semitism, we must have some sort of common understanding of what anti-Semitism is. So can you explain, as you aptly do in your book, what is anti-Semitism? And is there a definition of anti-Semitism that you find particularly useful?
Okay, well, I think there are a number of definitions of anti-Semitism. But I would argue that, let me start from the end sort of and go backwards. That if you were looking, if you look at any prejudice, you're studying any prejudice, whether it's a about a gender, whether it's about sexual preference, whether it's about race, there's and particular races, there's always a set, maybe one, maybe two, maybe more, of stereotypes associated with that prejudice. And if you move the stereotype from one group to the other, it doesn't work. You know, shiftless and lazy doesn't work for Jews. Money grubbing doesn't work for African Americans. Those, in terms of the stereotype, I want to be very clear. I'm talking here about the stereotypes. So the template of the stereotype for anti-Semitism, I would say, includes three, maybe four elements. One, money, something to do with finances, something to do with intellect, with smarts, but in a conniving way, and something to do with power. And you put the three together, that they all are used by Jews, the anti-Semite would say, in this conniving, malicious, nefarious way against others. So what I'm saying is that anti-Semitism has a structure. It is persistent. We could trace it back, you know, to early Middle Ages, if not earlier than that. And yet it morphs, it adapts. So I would argue that's my loosely held definition.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And in the book, you examine several different manifestations of anti-Semitism. You, of course, talk about extremists who are perhaps the easiest to recognize and the most obvious. But you also talk about anti-Semitic enablers, the dinner party anti-Semite, and the clueless anti-Semite, to name a few examples. Can you explain the differences between these varying manifestations of anti-Semitism? And would you say that there's a sort of category of anti-Semitism that is more dangerous than others?
I would say it's an interesting question. I would say this. I would say that let me first deal with each one. The extremist anti-Semite is the one we all recognize. It's the Hitlerian model. You know, it's the one marching down the street or across a college campus, as we saw in the United States a couple years ago, you know, with a tiki torch or with arms outstretched, chanting, "Jews will not replace us." It's the one that it's easiest to condemn and easiest to say, "I don't want to have anything to do with that person." It's like the guy who went into the synagogue in Pittsburgh. I know his name, but following the model of the Prime Minister of New Zealand and their recent tragedy in the mosque, I'm not going to mention his name. That extremist is easy to condemn and easy to recognize. But they're other types. And I think we do ourselves harm by not recognizing that. So in the book, I talk about the dinner party anti-Semite. The dinner party anti-Semite is the person who might never think of doing any physical harm to a Jew, a Jewish institution, but who will sit at dinner and say, well, we hired a new associate at our law firm, or we hired a new doctor at the hospital. He's a Jew, but he's very honest. He's a Jew, but we can trust him, something like that. In fact, it happened to me. It happened to me in a backwards way. It happened to me when at my first job, I was at the University of Washington in Seattle, a very fine university. I was at the history department teaching modern Jewish history. And I was the first person to ever be hired at the university with, you know, to teach with in a field with Jewish appended to it. Obviously, there were Jewish topics that were taught. If you were teaching contemporary American, 20th century American literature, you were teaching Jewish, American Jewish novelists, you know, Bellow, Malamud, post-war American literature, Roth. But this was an official position in Jewish history. And things worked out beautifully. I loved it. My classes were full. The students were excited. I was doing good work. And one day, towards the end of my first year there, a colleague took me out for coffee and he said, Deborah, I have to tell you something. When I first heard that you were coming here, a New York woman, a Jew, I was really worried about what we were going to get. And then you came and you are terrific. You're one of the best things, you're one of the best hires this department has ever made. I am so delighted that you're here. There's a journalist in DC, Frank Foyer, who describes a philo-Semite as an anti-Semite who likes Jews. And that was, you know, that was that form. So that's sort of the dinner party anti-Semite. Then you have what I call the anti-Semitic enabler, the person who may himself or herself not be an anti-Semite, but their words, their rhetoric, what they have to say enables, enhances, emboldens anti-Semites. And the anti-Semites think they're anti-Semites. So in that group, I include two people from polar opposites ends of the political spectrum. Jeremy Corbyn of the British Labour Party and Donald Trump, President of the United States. I have no idea if either of these men are anti-Semites. I'm more sure about one than the other, but that's beside the point, because that doesn't matter. No, it doesn't. It's irrelevant. If we get into an argument, is he an anti-Semite or is this one an anti-Semite, that one an anti-Semite? There's no end to the matter. You'll never resolve it. And you don't know. That's between them and their cardiologist. It's between them and, you know, them, and if they believe in a higher being, it's between them and their conscience. The question is, as political leaders with power to influence, have they enabled and emboldened anti-Semites? And I think in the case of both of them, they have, with their rhetoric. And if they were really opposed to it, they would tell their followers who engage in it, no, I don't believe in it. You know, Jeremy Corbyn has embraced anti-Semites, embraced deniers, refused Jews the right to define anti-Semitism, to identify anti-Semitism, told Jews that when they speak of anti-Semitism, they don't know what they're talking about, etc. And Donald Trump, you know, going back to his statement at Charlottesville, you know, nice people on both sides, his discussion of, you know, hordes of refugees, immigrants. And you might say, well, what do refugees and immigrants have to do with anti-Semitism? But that's all part, as we saw in the recent tragedy, tremendous tragedy in New Zealand at the mosque, at the two mosques. That's part of the nexus of white supremacy. And by the way, I don't like the word white nationalism. I prefer the word white supremacy, but I think they're both the same. You know, white nationalism sort of tries to give it a semi-respectable gloss. But the white supremacist is very much taken by what they call replacement theory. If your listeners want to go on a white nationalist website, white supremacist website, they'll see that. And what is replacement theory? Replacement theory argues that the white culture, whatever that is, the white European culture, whatever that is, the white male, whomever that is being quote unquote replaced by others with other cultures, with other ethnicities, with other skin colors, with other religions other than Christianity. And that this is a concerted effort to push whites out of their place of primacy and push white culture out of its well-deserved place of primacy. So argues the white supremacist. Now, who is doing this replacing? What white supremacists would argue, the person of color, whether black or brown or whatever, is not smart enough, is not capable enough to do this. Someone must be engineering this. Someone must be making this happen. Aha, we know who is behind the scenes. We know who acts in a devilish fashion. We know who knows how to control things without being seen. Who is that? The Jew. And that's why when they talk about the Rothschilds or they talk about George Soros, who are they? They're the behind the scenes power that are controlling these things. So that's another form of the anti-Semite. And the fourth form I address is what I call the clueless anti-Semite. The person who works with a Jew, has worked with a Jew for years, and without blinking an eyelash, without thinking, will say, oh, I got a great price on a new car. I Jewed him down. You know? And if you say to them, you did what? And they say, I Jewed him down. And you say, you know, that's not only offensive, but that's anti-Semitic. They will look at you and they will say, huh? And when you explain it to them or you call them on it, very often they will recognize it. So sometimes it's done in a clueless fashion, and sometimes I think it's done in obviously far from a clueless fashion.
Right, right. And would you say that it's difficult to sort of qualify, I guess, and maybe there isn't a point of this, but would you say that there is one type of anti-Semite or anti-Semitic rhetoric that's more dangerous than the other? Or are they all equally dangerous in their own different ways?
They're all equal dangerous in different ways. They all tend to use this. They use the template. The template is used in one way or another. Here's what I would say. The extremist is no more dangerous than the dinner party or the enabler. And of course, these aren't, you know, the edges of these different categories bleed into the other. They're not silos. So it's very easy to move from one to the other. But without the rhetoric of the enabler, without the rhetoric of the dinner party anti-Semite, the extremist doesn't do what he or she does.
Right, right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So as I mentioned earlier, and as you address with copious examples in your book, Anti-Semitic attacks have increased exponentially in the last decade or two decades or so. What factors contribute to this rise in anti-Semitism?
You know, first of all, I want to say that there may be the same number of anti-Semites around, but some of them have, just to borrow a phrase from another form of prejudice, come out of the closet, you know? So I don't want to get into whether they're more or they're fewer, but we certainly, as you said in your question, we see it more, it's out there more. I think there are a number of factors. First of all, I treat anti-Semitism as I think of it as a virus, a herpes virus. I know that the comparison is pretty disgusting, but herpes is the kind of thing that if it got into your body, I think now they have medication to deal with it, but up until recently, if it got into your body, it was virtually impossible to get it out. We've all heard the horror story of the person going for a big interview and he wakes up that morning and he's got a herpes sore on his lip or something, or the bride who gets a herpes outbreak right before her wedding. They're under tension, they're under pressure, and it comes out. I think anti-Semitism is something like that, in part because of its, not because of anything Jews do, but because of its longevity and its legs and its the way it is so deeply embedded in society. Now, by the way, when I say not because of it, the Jews who do bad things, but they're individuals. If a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant does something, we don't say we hate all white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. So you have to always be careful of moving from the individual to the group. I would say there are other reasons as well. So you have this virus there that's always ready to emerge. Anti-Semitism is also, going back a little bit to answering your question and back to one of your earlier questions in terms of categorization and definition, anti-Semitism, in addition to being a virus, is a conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theories seek to make sense of inexplicable situations. You know, why is it raining so much on the very week when I want to have my outdoor picnics and outdoor events? The gods are against me. And we all laugh that off. But if you say, why did my business go belly up? Well, those Jews started stores down the block, not a Jew, but the Jews. That's a conspiracy theory. You know, if you blame it on one group to sort of make what's happening to you understandable. So it's irrational. Therefore, seeking any explanation to why now is sort of to give a rational explanation to an irrational event. But having said that, I'll give explanations. You know? So we have it as a virus. We have it as a conspiracy theory now. We also have a time of great political and economic upheaval, a growing populism, a growing nationalism. And by the way, when I say nationalism, I am not meaning to suggest that I'm against patriotism. I'm a patriotic American. This country has been wonderful to generations of my family. My family has contributed a great deal to this country as well. So I think there's nothing wrong with being patriotic. But when you become nationalist, my country above all others, my country right or wrong, my country, if you succeed, it is at the cost to my country, you know, a zero-sum game, there can only be one winner, that kind of thing. And there's this growing populism also tends to demonize other groups. It builds one group up, your group up, the majority group up, by finding scapegoats in other groups. And we see that today. We see that today in the anti-Semitism, in the fear of Muslims. We see that in some of the racism. We certainly see it on a national level. Let's take Europe, in Hungary today, in Poland, though the current government in Poland seems to be under a little bit of electoral assault, but who knows. But certainly in Hungary, in Austria, in the Alternative for Deutschland, the AfD party, in Germany, in certain elements in Italy. Now, whether this is being stoked by outside forces, by interference from other countries, I don't know, but it is given expression. It is on the rise. And that also often plays into an anti-Semitism. So I think that's part of it too. That would be more on the political right. On the political left, we see it very much tied up with Israel, with opposition to Israeli policies, with opposition to Israel's existence. There's, let me say something straight out as we sort of, I don't know if you were planning to ask about this, but as sort of we segue into the topic of Israel, there's nothing anti-Semitic about criticizing Israeli policies. Absolutely nothing at all. But what we often have is a singular focus on human rights failings, human rights abuses by Israel to the exclusion of all other countries, whether it's in terms of human rights, whether it's women's rights, which of course are human rights, whether it's in terms of rights of LGBTQ people, which of course also are a subset of human rights. So this singular myopic focus, and also when you're looking at the issue of the Arab-Israeli or Israeli-Palestinian conflict and dispute, to see all the wrongs on one side, and to only see one side as responsible for the wrongs. And that too is problematic. The wonders of computers, it allows us to talk, but it also sometimes comes with its own challenge.
Certainly.
In any case. So, and I think that there are those on the left, the progressive left, and again, we see this in Corbyn's Labour Party or the group around Jeremy Corbyn, but not only there, who often intertwine their opposition or their standing on this this policy, Israel's policies, or their standing on Israel's existence, coat their criticisms in an or place their criticism, structure their criticisms in an anti-Semitic format, and that also adds to the rise. So it's a bunch of things. It's coming from the right. It's coming from the left. It comes from Islamists. Unlike this country, where most of the attacks have come from white supremacists and white white nationalists. The word again, I prefer white supremacists. In Europe, most of the attacks have come from Islamist extremists.
Can you, since we're talking about Israel, can you elaborate on the connection between anti-Semitism and the state of Israel, and why conversations about, you know, the issues with some Israeli politics and policies sort of stokes anti-Semitism? What's going on here? Can you unpack this for us?
Yeah, it's such, on one hand, it's so simple. And on the other hand, it is so complicated. And so many people, you know, feel like if I'm going to tread on it, it's a minefield that's going to explode in my face. But it shouldn't be. As I said earlier, criticism of Israeli policies is not anti-Semitic. I would hope, look, I criticize American policies. I hope no one calls me anti-American because I criticize American policies. You know, Canadians criticize, et cetera, et cetera. It's no need to belabor that. But it's, I'll give you an example. We had an incident here in the United States in the month of February, beginning of March, with a newly elected member of the House of Representatives, Representative Omar from Minnesota, who is Somali-born and came to this country as a refugee, and is now elected to the House. Not the first refugee to be elected to the House, but certainly it is quite a remarkable development. And she, first of all, she had tweeted back way back about, 6 years ago, about how Israel hypnotized the rest of the world into supporting it. And that is part of that anti-Semitic template, you know, that what I talked about, that working behind the scenes, you can't quite identify who is doing what, you can't quite put your finger on them. They're mystical, they're demons, and that hypnotizing. And she apologized for that. But then more recently, when she was talking about support of Israel, she tweeted, "It's all about the Benjamin's baby." Now, first of all, a very flippant way, but she wasn't talking about Israeli policies there. She was talking, she was accusing supporters of Israel of buying off politicians with their money to get support for Israel. That that was the only reason. There wasn't an affinity in terms of heritage. There wasn't an affinity in terms of politics. There wasn't an affinity in terms of democracy. There wasn't an affinity in terms of history, et cetera, et cetera. It was only about surreptitious under the table Benjamin's baby, you know. And then later, she, in a speech, she openly accused supporters of Israel of dual loyalty. And the dual loyalty, whether made against Muslims, made against Jews, made against anyone, is a very tricky thing. But it's especially so against Jews because it's part of that anti-Semitic template, that Jews are more loyal to one another than they are to their country. That they're going to support a Jew in, I don't know, in Uzbekistan faster than they're going to support an American or a Canadian or whatever it is living next to them. That their only concern are Jews and no one else. That their only concern are Jews and no one else. And that is part of the anti-Semitic template. Jews were accused of being cosmopolitans. What is cosmopolitan? Not in the way that always very cosmopolitan, sophisticated, et cetera, worldly, but that they weren't nationals. They were committed one to the other and not to the not to the country. And that she was, so she was in her criticism, in her comments, she was really taking a hit, not at Israeli policies, but at the loyalty of Americans, at the loyalty of American Jews, at the loyalty of other many other Americans who support Israel. So there you see the anti-Semitic template being used supposedly to criticize Israeli policies, but of course it had nothing to do with Israeli policies. And that's why it upset so many people.
Right, right. And also related to the state of Israel, the BDS movement is, well, and you discuss this a lot in your book, is a major issue on many college campuses in the United States. So can you maybe talk about how, well, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement has impacted discourse about the state of Israel and, again, sort of seems to stoke anti-Semitism and how that affects students on college campuses?
Right, right. I think it's sort of ironic. You and I couldn't have this conversation if we were adhering to BDS. Most college students would whip out their smartphone and it would be dead if they were adhering to BDS, you know? So it's a ridiculous kind of thing. It's not going to happen. And in fact, I would argue that if you listen to the founders of the BDS movement, what you'll find is that their objective is not really to engage in a boycott of Israel. Their objective is to toxify Israel, to make Israel toxic. Now, I believe there are supporters of BDS on college campuses. I meet them all the time who are not out to toxify Israel and not out for the destruction of Israel and are not anti-Semites at all. They just see this as a way of possibly changing Israeli policies, a way of impacting Israeli policies. However, if you look at the founding documents of the BDS movement, if you look at the statements made by the founders of the BDS movement, clearly what their intention is the destruction of the state of Israel. And, you know, the destruction of the state of Israel, I find overtly anti-Semitic. Maybe you could have had a debate about the wisdom of the existence of a state of Israel. You know, you had the debate in the 30s. Jews were debating it mightily in the 20s and the 30s, even in the 40s. But once you had a state, and today you have a state with 6-7 million Jews living in that state, to argue that, oh, I'm all I'm interested in is, you know, a one-state solution or to end the state of Israel, or as a famous journalist, Helen Thomas, now deceased, said in the United States, oh, they should all go back to Poland. You know, well, the fact is that over 52% of the Jews in Israel come from Africa, Iran, Iraq, North Africa, you know, Yemen, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, they would be considered in the racial way of looking at the world, quote unquote, people of color. They're certainly not Eastern European Poles. or any other part of Europe. BDS, so some of the people who support it see it just as a way of changing policy. But I think if you go to the heart of the matter, it's an argument for the toxification and the end of the state of Israel. And that's why I don't support it. I also don't support boycotts in general. Boycotts are I teach in a university. Universities are built on open exchange of ideas. Universities are built on learning about what others say. You know, a couple of years ago, Salman Rushdie, who was here in residence at Emory University, where I teach, described the American college campus as a becoming an insult-free zone. And I think if he were saying it today, he would say it has become an insult-free zone, where you have the best universities. I mentioned some of them in the book. Wellesley, a group of professors, students and professors in different contexts, put themselves forward as saying, you know, yes, there's a First Amendment, but the greater right is not to be hurt. We shouldn't hear things that are hurtful. Or a group of professors who put themselves forward, we will vet what can be said and what can't be said. Well, to my mind, that's McCarthyism of the left, you know? And so you don't boycott, you engage in argument, you engage in exchange. But, you know, and there are some universities which have said to professors, well, we'll let you come if you acknowledge before you come that you don't agree with the policies of your country. Well, that's a loyalty oath. And those are the exact kind of things that in earlier generations, in the 50s and early 60s, we were fighting against because, you know, you had to take a loyalty oath that you weren't a communist, you'd never been a communist, et cetera, et cetera. And we said, no, that's the but I'm speaking figuratively. I'm not that old. We said no. That's exactly what the university is not supposed to be. So now it's turned around because it's coming from the left. It's okay.
So why is there this pressure on Israeli scholars, for example, to denounce Israeli politics? Where is that coming from?
It's coming from the left. It's coming from the people who oppose Israel or Israeli policies or the existence of Israel. I can't speak for them. But it's certainly if they were being consistent with their so-called liberal values, they wouldn't be demanding it. And I think it's wrong. Why should a professor of medieval church mosaics, as uncovered in archaeological sites in Israel, have to say, and I disagree with Benjamin Netanyahu, I disagree with Israeli policies, et cetera, before they can give a lecture on the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But that's the inconsistency, and that's coming from the left.
I'm going to shift our conversation a little bit to Holocaust deniers. You talk about sort of this phenomenon in the book. First of all, what is Holocaust denial? And how do some Holocaust deniers disguise anti-Semitism, racism, and prejudice as rational discourse, as you say?
Well, Holocaust denial, first and foremost, let me deal with the second half of your question before I get into the weeds of what constitutes Holocaust denial. Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism, nothing more, nothing less. It's not an edgy view of history. Think about it. I gave a TED talk on this once, and some of your listeners might be interested in it. But in the talk, I say, think about it. For deniers to be right, who would have to be wrong? Well, first, all the survivors who tell their story and whose stories buttress one another, you know? But setting that aside, certainly all the bystanders, the people in the Polish cities and towns and villages near the death camp, who watched the trains going in day after day, coming out empty, who knew what was going on in there. I'm not saying that there was very much they could have done at that point, but they knew what was going on there. All the thousands of historians, American historians, Canadian historians, European, throughout every corner of Europe, Japan. I was in Japan recently and I met historians dealing with this. Israeli historians would either have to be part of the hoax or have been duped into accepting this hoax. And fourth, and most importantly, the perpetrators. The perpetrators, including those who were, let's say, on trial or something. No one ever said it didn't happen. What they said was, I didn't do it, or I had no choice. Germany itself, you know, says we did it. Deniers will say to you, oh, the reason they do that is because if they didn't, they weren't going to be admitted back into the family of nations. The Jews told them you have to admit to this terrible crime. And again, it's that delusional conspiratorial theory of the power of the Jew. So Holocaust denial makes no sense. The Holocaust has the dubious distinction of being the best documented genocide in the world. So if you were to ask a denier, why did the Jews make up this story? Why did they go to so much effort to create this myth and build museums and memorials and et cetera, and have people parade as survivors and get historians to write thousands of books on the topic, et cetera? They would say, a denier would say, well, what did the Jews, quote unquote, get out of the Holocaust? And the answer often given is Israel, which historically is not entirely correct because the British were looking to create some sort of political entity in Israel long before, well before the Holocaust. But anyway, that's the perception. Israel. And what else did they get? They got reparations from Germany. What's reparations? A fancy word for money. So there you have the anti-Semitic template. You know, you tell someone who is engaged in Western culture has been exposed to anti-Semitism, just like someone engaged in Western culture is exposed to racism. It's almost impossible. It's impossible to avoid. And you give them a rational explanation based on these anti-Semitic stereotypes that I talked about earlier in our conversation. So Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. It's completely irrational. There is no evidence. There is no narrative. There are no witnesses. There are no documents. Because if you look closely at the documents, I was on trial. I was sued for libel by a Holocaust denier. I was on trial. The trial itself took 10 weeks. And preparation for it took a very long time. And we showed that every one of their claims is based on either a made-up document, a misread of the document, the change of the document, only half the document, that it's fallacious. The judge found strongly for us, in fact, that your listeners, if they want to explore this further, can see the transcripts and the judgment at a site called hdot.org, which is an Emory University website. So Holocaust denial is a form of anti-Semitism. That doesn't mean that there's an orthodoxy about the Holocaust, that everyone has to agree it happened exactly as one way or the other. Because if you read different historians, one argues that it was something that only the Germans could have perpetrated, and others argue, no, anti-Semitism was so virulent in Europe that it could have come from many countries. And people have many different views on things that otherwise you wouldn't have this large library of books with historians debating one another. Was Hitler's motivation primarily anti-Semitism? Was it to capture Eastern territories and have an unending supply of food for Germans and slave labor for Germans? They're different explanation and different debates. Was it Hitler's idea first? Did it start with Hitler? Did it start with people beneath him? Did it start with both working towards the middle? So we have many, many debates about this. But there is no debate that millions of Jews, and there's even debate how many, was it 5.2, was it 6? Now there are many historians who are beginning to believe it's more than 6 because we're discovering burial sites that of places we didn't know, with 1,000 Jews here, 500 Jews here in Belarus and the Ukraine and other places. So there's room to debate, and there has to be debate, but to say that it didn't happen, to say that it was all made up, to say, because where did these Jews go? We know they existed. I mean, there are censuses that show they existed. Yes, there deniers will show you a census that doesn't, but it's based on quasi information. There's no question that millions of Jews disappeared. They used to say, oh, they're behind the Soviet Union and they can't come out. But when the Soviet Union ended in the late 80s, early 90s, they didn't all appear. So there is no narrative. There is no evidence. It's a complete completely ridiculous kind of thing. And you have to ask, why does it get any traction? It's attractive to anti-Semites, to white supremacists, etc.
Wonderful. Thank you for that explanation. And that TED Talk that you referenced was, I actually watched it recently. And for folks who want to hear more about this, they should absolutely watch it. We don't have enough time to go through all that, all the sort of all the things you mentioned in that TED Talk, but it's fascinating. And there was also a movie that was made based on your on your experience in court, right?
Yes, there was. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a very good movie with a screenplay by David Hare, starring Rachel Weisz, which isn't a bad person to have to portray your life.
True.
It also, if I had made the movie, it would have been 4 hours long. But for an hour and 50 minutes, I think it does a really good job of explaining what the issue was all about. It's a very fine movie with a very, very good screenplay.
Well, we're approaching the end of our time. I have a couple more questions. My second to last question for you is, what is the best way to combat anti-Semitism, racism, and hate?
Oh, now you get to the hard stuff.
Just as we're ending.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you waited till now, because to be very honest, and one might think otherwise, I don't have an easy answer for that. It would be, you know, you would think someone had just spent 2.5-3 years writing a book that you would have an answer. One, do this, do that. It's the oldest hatred. It's the longest hatred. It's old wine in new bottles. But I think there are certain things we can do. And by the way, they pertain not just to anti-Semitism, prejudice in general. A, we can become the unwelcome. We have to be the unwelcome guest at the dinner party. The person who won't be silent when an anti-Semitic, racist, homophobic, whatever comment is made, who doesn't sit silently by because they don't want to upset things. We can't afford to do that. Doesn't mean you have to ram the soup down the person's neck, you know, down their throat, but you have to say, I don't accept that. We don't talk that way. We have to say it not to change the haters' point of view, because most of the time you can't change their point of view, but for the people at the table, especially the young people, that not only don't we believe this, but we don't speak that way. It's two different things. Because the kids may know you don't think that way, but they got to know that that kind of talk isn't acceptable. There was recently an incident, I think in early March of 2019, in a DC public school, a public school that happened to have mainly Caucasian students, very, very few students of color. But there were some, and there were kids playing, I think, football at recess time. And a Caucasian child was playing with a couple of other children of color. And at one point, he used the N-word on them. And the game stopped or whatever. And he said, I don't care. You can call me a racist, but I don't care. Doesn't matter. I don't care if you call me a racist. Well, that kind of talk doesn't come. This is a fifth grader, so that would make them, 11, 12, something like that. That kind of talk doesn't come ex nihilo. He heard that somewhere. He heard that at home. He heard that from a parent. That's pretty powerful kind of talk. So we have to telegraph that kind of talk is unacceptable. Maybe that kid is salvageable, not through his family, but through people around him. So becoming unwelcome guests at the dinner party, A. B, recognizing that anti-Semitism B, not just seeing anti-Semitism or prejudice in general, but certainly in this case, anti-Semitism on the other side of the political transom. In other words, if you're on the left and you only see it on the right, or you're on the right and you only see it on the left, then you're blind to what's going on next to you. And your claims are invalid. Because if you only see it on the other side, then I have to think that you don't really, you aren't really concerned about anti-Semitism. You're more concerned about making political points. So I think that would be another factor. And I think, the third or another thing to do, to recognize, And I think a third thing to recognize is that in fighting this scourge of prejudice in general, and here we're talking about anti-Semitism specifically, not to see ourselves as doing it for the Jews, or if you're a Jew, for my own group, or if you have Jewish relatives, for my Jewish relatives, or my Jewish neighbors, or my Jewish colleagues. I told them, you know, because I didn't want you to be hurt. That's a good reason, but it's not a sufficient reason. Nor should we be doing it solely because, well, I hate prejudice of all kinds. So anybody who engages in prejudice, I'm going to tell them it's wrong. That's a good reason, but it's not a sufficient reason. The reason we should be so concerned and outraged and anxious to fight as much as possible against this scourge is that no democratic society can tolerate having this hateful conspiracy theory in its midst and continue to be a healthy democratic society. If you believe in this conspiracy theory, you'll believe in any conspiracy theory about the economy, about politics, about the weather, I don't know, whatever it might be. It's an unhealthy element to have in your society. It's the degradation of democracy. It's the rot from which the death of democracy follows. And I feel that very strongly.
Well, we're approaching the end of our time. Thank you so much for this interview, and it's been extremely enlightening and an important discussion to have, and our viewers will certainly appreciate it. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me, and thank you for your close read of the book. And I don't usually show my own books. I've written many books and they sell well enough without my having to show them. But I really hope people read this book and think about the issues contained therein. Most of my books have dealt with history, with what was, or with how people distort history. This is the first time I've ever written about something that is present, that is happening right now. And I think it's terribly important that we address it, and for people not to say, well, I'm not Jewish, my friends aren't Jewish, I don't really know many Jews, I'm not an anti-Semite, so it's not my business. It is everybody's business, because as I said earlier, it's so relevant to wiping it out is so crucial to having a healthy democratic society.
Absolutely. Said beautifully. Well, thank you again. And the book Anti-Semitism Here and Now is out now, and it's a fantastic read, and I absolutely recommend it to all of our viewers. It's really, and it's quite poignant for our time, of course, as you've said. Thanks again, Deborah, and take care.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.